but count our Achaeans out by 10-man squads, and each squad pick a Trojan to pour its wine. Many Achaean tens would lack their steward then. That's how far we outnumber them. I'd say Achaeans to Trojans, the men who hail from Troy at least, but they have allies called from countless cities, fighters brandishing spears who block my way, who throw me far off course, thwarting my will to plunder Ilium's rugged walls. And now, 9 years of almighty Zeus have marched by, our chipped timbers rot and the cables snap and fray. And across the sea, our wives and helpless children wait in the halls, wait for our return. And we? Our work drags on, unfinished as always, hopeless. The labor of war that brought us here to Troy. So come, follow my orders. All obey me now. Cut and run. Sail home to the fatherland we love. We'll never take the broad streets of Troy.
Testing his men, but he only made the spirit race inside their chests, all the rank and file who'd never heard his plan. And the whole assembly surged like big waves at sea, the Icarian Sea, when east and south winds drive it on, blasting down in force on the clouds of Father Zeus, or when the west wind shakes the deep-standing grain, with hurricane gusts that flatten down the stalks. So the massed assembly of troops was shaken now. They cried in alarm, and charged towards the ships, and the dust went whirling up from under rushing feet, as the men jostled back and forth, shouting orders.
"Grapple the ships! Drag them down to the bright sea! Clean out the launching channels!"
Shrill shouts hitting the heavens. Fighters racing for home, knocking the blocks out underneath the hulls. And now they might have won their journey home, the men of Argos, fighting the will of fate. Yes, if Hera had not alerted Athena. Inconceivable! Child of Zeus, whose battle shield is thunder, tireless one Athena, what is this the way? All the Argives flying home to their fatherland, sailing over the seas broad back, leaving Priam and all the men of Troy a trophy to glory over. Helen of Argos, Helen, for whom so many Argives lost their lives in Troy, far from native land. Go, range the ranks of Achaeans armed in bronze. With your winning words, hold back each man you find. Don't let them haul their rolling ships to sea. The bright-eyed goddess Pallas lost no time. Down she flashed from the peaks of Mount Olympus, quickly reached the ships, and found Odysseus first, a mastermind like Zeus, still standing fast. He had not laid a hand on his black-benched hull. Such anguish racked his heart and fighting spirit. Now, close beside him, the bright-eyed goddess stood and urged him on. "Royal son of Laertes, Odysseus, great tactician, what? Is this the way? All you Argives flying home to your fatherland, tumbling into your oar-swept ships, leaving Priam and all the men of Troy a trophy to glory over. Helen of Argos, Helen, for whom so many Argives lost their lives in Troy, far from native land. No, don't give up now. Range the Achaean ranks. With your winning words, hold back each man you find. Don't let them haul their rolling ships to sea." He knew the goddess's voice. He went on the run, flinging off his cape as Eurybates picked it up, the herald of Ithaca, always at his side. Coming face to face with Atrides Agamemnon, he relieved him of his father's royal scepter. Its power can never die. And, grasping it tightly, off he strode to the ships of Argives, armed in bronze. Whenever Odysseus met some man of rank, a king, he'd halt and hold him back with winning words.
"My friend, it's wrong to threaten you like a coward, but stand you fast, you keep your men in check. It's too soon to see Agamemnon's purpose clearly. Now he's only testing us. Soon he'll bear down hard. Didn't we all hear his plan in secret council? God forbid his anger destroy the army he commands. The rage of kings is strong, they're nursed by the gods. Their honor comes from Zeus, they're dear to Zeus, the god who rules the world."
When he caught some common soldier shouting out, he'd beat him with a scepter, dress him down.
"You fool! Sit still! Obey the commands of others, your superiors! You deserter, rank coward! You count for nothing, neither in war nor council. How can all Achaeans be masters here in Troy? Too many kings can ruin an army, mob rule. Let there be one commander, one master only, endowed by the son of crooked-minded Cronos with kingly scepter and royal rights of custom. Whatever one man needs to lead his people well.
So he reins the ranks, commanding men to order. And back again they surged, from ships and shelters, back to the meeting grounds with a deep pounding din, thundering out as battle lines of breakers crash and drag along some endless beach, and the rough sea roars. The armies took their seats, marshalled into ranks, but one man, Thersites, still railed on, non-stop. His head was full of obscenities, teeming with rant, all for no good reason, insubordinate, baiting the kings, anything to provoke some laughter from the troops. Here was the ugliest man who ever came to Troy. Bandy-legged he was, with one foot clubbed, both shoulders humped together, curving over his caved-in chest, and bobbing above them his skull, warped to a point, sprouting clumps of scraggly, woolly hair. Achilles despised him most. Odysseus, too. He was always abusing both chiefs, but now he went for majestic Agamemnon, hollering out, taunting the king with strings of cutting insults. The Achaeans were furious with him, deeply offended, but he kept shouting at Agamemnon, spewing his abuse.
"Still moaning and groaning, mighty Atrides? Why now? What are you panting after now? Your shelters packed with a lion's share of bronze. Plenty of women, too, crowding your lodges. Best of the lot, the beauties, we hand you first whenever we take some stronghold. Or still more gold you're wanting? More ransom a son of the stallion-breaking Trojans might just fetch from Troy, though I, or another hero, drags him back in chains. Or a young woman, is it? To spread and couple, to bed down for yourself apart from all the troops. How shameful for you, the high and mighty commander, to lead the sons of Achaea into bloody slaughter. Sons? No, my soft friends, wretched excuses, women, not men of Achaea. Home we go in our ships. Abandon him here in Troy to wallow in all his prizes. He'll see if the likes of us have propped him up or not. Oh, look, now it's Achilles. A greater man he disgraces, seizes and keeps his prize, tears it away himself. But no gall in Achilles. Achilles lets it go. If not Atrides, that outrage would have been your last.
So Thersites taunted the famous field marshal. But Odysseus stepped in quickly, faced him down with a dark glance and threats to break his nerve.
What a flood of abuse, Thersites! Even for you, fluent and flowing as you are. Keep quiet. Who are you to wrangle with kings? You alone? No one, I say, no one alive less soldierly than you. None in the ranks that came to Troy with Agamemnon. So stop your babbling. Mouthing the names of kings, flinging indecencies in their teeth. Your eyes peeled for a chance to cut and run for home. We can have no idea, no clear idea at all, how the long campaign will end, whether Achaea's sons will make it home unharmed, or slink back in disgrace. But there you sit, hurling abuse at the son of Atreus, Agamemnon, marshal of armies, simply because our fighters give Atrides the lion's share of all our plunder. You and your ranting slander, you're the outrage. I tell you this, so help me it's the truth. If I catch you again blithering on this way, let Odysseus's head be wrenched off his shoulders. Never again call me the father of Telemachus. If I don't grab you, strip the clothing off you, cloak, tunic and rags that wrap your private parts, and whip you howling naked back to the fast ships, out of the army's muster, whip you like a cur. And he cracked the scepter across his back and shoulders. The rascal doubled over, tears streaking his face, and a bloody welt bulged up between his blades under the stroke of the golden scepter's studs. He squatted low, cringing, stunned with pain, blinking like some idiot,
rubbing his tears off dumbly with a fist. Their morale was low, but the men laughed now. Good, hearty laughter breaking over Thersites' head. Glancing at neighbours, they would shout, "Terrific stroke! 1,000 terrific strokes! He's carried off! Odysseus taking the lead in tactics, mapping battle plans. But here's the best thing yet he's done for the men. He's put a stop to this babbling, foul-mouthed fool. Never again, I'd say, will our gallant comrade risk his skin to attack the kings with insults." So the soldiers bantered, but not Odysseus. The raider of cities stood there, scepter in hand, and close beside him the great grey-eyed Athena rose like a herald, ordering men to silence. All, from the first to lowest ranks of Achaea's troops, should hear his words and mark his counsel well. For the good of all, he urged them, "Agamemnon, now, my king, the Achaeans are bent on making you a disgrace in the eyes of every man alive. Yes, they failed to fulfill their promise sworn that day they sailed here from the stallion land of Argos, that not until you had raised the rugged walls of Troy would they sail home again. But look at them now, like green, defenseless boys, or widowed women whimpering to each other, wailing to journey back. True, they've labored long. They're desperate for home. Any fighter cut off from his wife for 1 month would chafe at the benches, moaning in his ship, pinned down by gales and heavy, raging seas. 1 month! But look at us! This is the 9th year come round. The 9th we've hung on here. Who could blame the Achaeans for chafing, bridling beside the beaked ships? Ah, but still, what a humiliation it would be to hold out so long, then sail home empty-handed. Courage, my friends! Hold out a little longer, till we see if Calchas divined the truth or not. We all recall that moment. Who could forget it? We were all witnesses then. All at least the deadly spirits have not dragged away. Why, it seems like only yesterday, or the day before, when our vast armada gathered, moored at Aulis, freighted with slaughter, bound for Priam's Troy. We were all busy then, milling round a spring and offering victims up on the holy altars. Full sacrifice to the gods to guarantee success. Under a spreading plane tree where the water splashed, glittering in the sun, when a great omen appeared. A snake, and his back streaked red with blood, a thing of terror. Olympian Zeus himself had launched him into the clean light of day. He slid from under the altar, glided up the tree, and there the brood of a sparrow, helpless young ones, teetered high on the topmost branch tips, cowering under the leaves there. 8 they were, all told, and the mother made the 9th. She'd borne them all, chirping to break the heart. But the snake gulped them down, and the mother cried out for her babies, fluttering over him. He coiled, struck, fanging her wing, a high, thin shriek. But once he'd swallowed down the sparrow with her brood, the son of crooked Cronos, who sent the serpent forth, turned him into a sign, a monument clear to see. Zeus struck him to stone. And we stood by, amazed that such a marvel came to light. So then, when those terrible, monstrous omens burst in on the victims we were offering to the gods, Calchas swiftly revealed the will of Zeus. Why struck dumb now, my long-haired Achaeans? Zeus, who rules the world, has shown us an awesome sign, an event long in the future. Late to come to birth, but the fame of that great work will never die. As the snake devoured the sparrow with her brood, 8, and the mother made the 9th, she'd borne them all. So we will fight in Troy that many years, and then in the 10th, we'll take her broad streets. So that day the prophet revealed the future. And now, look, by God, it all comes to pass. Up with you! All you Argives geared for combat, stand your ground right here, until we take the mighty walls of Priam. He fired them so, the armies roared, and the ships resounded round them, shattering echoes ringing from their shouts, as Argives cried assent to King Odysseus's words. And Nestor, the noble horseman, spurred them more.
What disgrace! Look at you, carrying on in the army's muster just like boys! Fools! Not a thought in your heads for works of battle. What becomes of them now? The pacts and oaths we swore. Into the flames with counsels, all the plans of men. The vows sealed with the strong, unmixed wine. The firm clasp of the right hand we trusted. We battle on in words, as always, mere words. And what's the cure? We cannot find a thing. No matter how many years we wrangle here. Agamemnon, never swerve. Hold to your first plan of action. Lead your armies headlong into war. The rest of them, let them rot. The one or two who hatch their plans apart from all the troops, what good can they win from that? Nothing at all. Why, they'd scuttle home before they could even learn if the vows of Zeus with his dark cloudy shield are false or not. Zeus, the son of almighty Cronus, I remind you, bowed his head that day we boarded ship. All the Argives laden with blood and death for Troy. His lightning bolts on the right, good omens, blazing forth. So now let no man hurry to sail for home. Not yet. Not till he beds down with a faithful Trojan wife. Payment in full for the groans and shocks of war we have all borne for Helen. But any soldier, wild with desire to reach his home at once, just let him lay a hand on his black-benched ship, and right in front of the rest he'll reach his death. But you, my king, be on your guard yourself. Come, listen well to another man. Here's some advice not to be tossed aside, and I will tell it clearly. Range your men by tribes, even by clans, Agamemnon. So clan fights by the side of clan, tribe by tribe. Fight this way, if the Argives still obey you. Then you can see which captain is a coward, which contingent too, and which is loyal, brave, since they will fight in separate formations of their own. Then, what's more, if you fail to sack the city, you will know if the will of God's to blame, or the cowardice of your men, inept in battle.
And King Agamemnon took his lead, saluting.
Again, old man, you outfight the Argives in debate. Father Zeus, Athena, Apollo, if only I had 10 men like Nestor to plan with me among Achaea's armies, then we could topple Priam's citadel in a day, throttle it in our hands, and gut Troy to nothing. But Cronus' son Zeus, with his shield of storm, insists on embroiling me in painful struggles, futile wars of words. Imagine, I and Achilles wrangling over a girl, battling man to man. And I was the first to let my anger flare. Gah! If the two of us could ever think as one, Troy could delay her day of death no longer. Not one moment! Go now. Take your meal. The sooner to bring on war. Quickly! Let each fighter sharpen his spear well, balance his shield well, feed his horses well, with plenty of grain to build their racing speed. Each man look well to his chariot's running order. Nerve himself for combat now, so all day long we can last out the grueling duels of Ares. No breathing space, no let-up, not a moment. Not till the night comes on to part the fighter's fury. Now sweat will soak the shield strap round your chest. Your fist gripping the spear will ache with tensing. Now the lather will drench your war team's flanks, hauling your sturdy chariot. But any man I catch trying to skulk behind his long-beaked ships, hanging back from battle, he is finished. No way for him to escape the dogs and birds.
So he commanded, and the armies gave a deep resounding roar like waves crashing against a cliff when the south wind whips it, bearing down some craggy headland jutting out to sea. The waves will never leave it in peace, thrashed by gales that hit from every quarter, breakers left and right. The troops sprang up, scattered back to the ships, lit fires beside their tents, and took their meal. each sacrifice to one or another deathless god, each man praying to flee death and the grind of war. But the lord of men, Agamemnon, sacrificed a fat, rich ox, 5 years old, to the son of mighty Cronos, Zeus, and called the chiefs of all the Argive forces, Nestor first and foremost, then King Idomeneus, the great and little Ajax, Tydeus's son, Diomedes, and Odysseus, sixth, a mastermind like Zeus. The lord of the war-cry Menelaus came uncalled. He knew at heart what weighed his brother down. They stood in a ring around the ox, took up barley, and then, rising among them, King Agamemnon raised his voice in prayer.
Zeus! Zeus! God of greatness! God of glory! Lord God of the dark clouds who lives in the bright sky! Don't let the sun go down or the night descend on us. Not till I hurl the smoke-black halls of Priam headlong, torch his gates to blazing rubble, rip the tunic of Hector, and slash his heroic chest to ribbons with my bronze, and a ruck of comrades round him, grovelling face down, gnaw their own earth.
And so Agamemnon prayed. But the son of Cronos would not bring his prayer to pass. Not yet. The father accepted the sacrifice, is true, but doubled the weight of thankless, ruthless war. Once the men had prayed and flung the barley, first they lifted back the heads of the victims, slit their throats, skinned them, and carved away the meat from the thigh bones and wrapped them in fat. A double fold, sliced clean, and topped with strips of flesh. And they burnt these on a cleft stick, peeled and dry, spitted the vitals, held them over Hephaestus's flames, and once they charred the thighs and tasted the organs, they cut the rest into pieces, pierced them with spits, roasted them to a turn, and pulled them off the fire. The work done, the feast laid out, they ate well, and no man's hunger lacked a share of the banquet. When they had put aside desire for food and drink, Nestor, the noble old horseman, spoke out first.
Marshal Atrides, lord of men, Agamemnon, no more trading speeches now, no more delay, putting off the work the god puts in our hands. Come, let the heralds cry out to all contingents, full battle armour, muster the men along the ships. Now down we go, united, review them as we pass. Down through the vast encampment of Achaea, the faster to rouse the slashing god of war.
Agamemnon, the lord of men, did not resist. He commanded heralds to cry out loud and clear, and summon the long-haired Achaean troops to battle. Their cries rang out. The battalions gathered quickly. The warlords, dear to the gods and flanking Agamemnon, strode on ahead, marshalling men-at-arms in files. And down their ranks the fiery-eyed Athena bore her awesome shield of storm, ageless, deathless. 100 golden tassels, all of them braided tight and each worth 100 oxen, float along the front. Her shield of lightning, dazzling, swirling around her. Headlong on, Athena swept through the Argive armies, driving soldiers harder, lashing the fighting fury in each Achaean's heart. No stopping them now, mad for war and struggle. Now, suddenly, battle thrilled them more than the journey home, than sailing hollow ships to their dear native land. As ravening fire rips through big stands of timber, high on a mountain ridge, and the blaze flares miles away, so from the marching troops the blaze of bronze armour, splendid and superhuman, flared across the earth, flashing into the air to hit the skies. Armies gathering now as the huge flocks on flocks of winging birds, geese or cranes, or swans with their long lancing necks, circling Asian marshes round the Caista outflow, wheeling in all directions, glorying in their wings, keep on landing, advancing, wave on shrieking wave, and the tidal flats resound. So tribe on tribe, pouring out of the ships and shelters, marched across the Scamander plain, and the earth shook. Tremendous thunder from under trampling men and horses, drawing into position down the Scamander meadow flats, breaking into flower, men by the thousands, numberless as the leaves and spears that flower forth in spring. The army's massing, crowding thick and fast as the swarms of flies seething over the shepherd's stalls in the first spring days when the buckets flood with milk. So many long-haired Achaeans swarmed across the plain to confront the Trojans, fired to smash their lines. The armies, grouping now, as seasoned goat-herds, split their wide-ranging flocks into packs with ease, when herds have mixed together down the pasture. So the captains formed their tight platoons, detaching right and left, moving up for action. And there in the midst strode powerful Agamemnon, eyes and head like Zeus, who loves the lightning, great in the girth like Ares, god of battles, broad through the chest like sea-lord Poseidon, like a bull rising head and shoulders over the herds, a royal bull rearing over his flocks of driven cattle. So imposing was Atreus's son, so Zeus made him that day, towering over fighters, looming over armies.
So the Achaean armies massed across the Scamander plain, while Achilles raged apart. Off in his beaked sea-going ships he lay, raging away at Atrides Agamemnon, king of armies, while his men sported along the surf, marking time, hurling the discus, throwing spears, and testing bows. And now, as the Trojans all assembled hard by Priam's gates, Zeus sent Iris, the wind-quick messenger, down to Troy, bearing a painful message. Ceaseless war is upon us. I've never seen an army great as this. Too much, like piling leaves or sand, and on they come, advancing across the plain to fight before our gates. Now forth from the city marched the Trojans and their many allies, the Paeonians, the Meonians, the Lycians, the Dardanians, the Thracians, and others, and among their leaders came Hector, supreme commander of the Trojans, son of King Priam, Paris, Hector's brother, magnificent as a god, Aeneas, the mortal son of Aphrodite, captain of the Dardanians, the staunch Polydamas, Hector's wise counselor, Sarpedon, son of Zeus, commander of the Lycians, and Glaucus, his valiant aide-in-arms.
Now, with the squadrons marshaled, captains leading each, the Trojans came with cries and the din of war, like wildfowl when the long hoarse cries of cranes sweep on against the sky, and the great formations flee from winter's grim, ungodly storms, flying in force, shrieking south to the ocean gulfs, speeding blood and death to the pygmy warriors, launching at daybreak savage battle down upon their heads. But Achaea's armies came on strong in silence, breathing combat fury, hearts ablaze to defend each other to the death. When the south wind showers mist on the mountain tops, no friend to shepherds, better than night to thieves, you can see no further than you can fling a stone. So dust came clouding, swirling up from the feet of armies marching at top speed, trampling through the plain. Now closer, closing, front to front in the onset, till Paris sprang from the Trojan forward ranks, a challenger, lithe, magnificent as a god, the skin of a leopard slung across his shoulders, a reflex bow at his back, and battle sword at hip. And brandishing two sharp spears tipped in bronze, he strode forth, challenging all the Argive best to fight him face to face in mortal combat. Soon as the warrior Menelaus marked him, Paris parading there with his big loping strides, flaunting before the troops, Atrides thrilled like a lion lighting on some handsome carcass, lucky to find an antlered stag or wild goat, just as hunger strikes. He rips it, bolts it down, even with running dogs and lusty hunters rushing him. So Menelaus thrilled at heart. Princely Paris there, right before his eyes. The outlaw, the adulterer. Now for revenge, he thought. And down he leapt from his chariot, fully armed, and hit the ground. But soon as magnificent Paris marked Atrides, shining among the champions, Paris's spirit shook. Backing into his friendly ranks, he cringed from death, as one who trips on a snake in a hilltop hollow recoils suddenly. Trembling grips his knees, and pallor takes his cheeks, and back he shrinks. So he dissolved again in the proud Trojan lines, dreading Atrides, magnificent, brave Paris. At one glance, Hector raked his brother with insults, stinging taunts. Paris! Appalling Paris! Our prince of beauty, mad for women, you lure them all to ruin. Would to God you'd never been born, died unwed. That's all I'd ask. Better that way by far than to have you strutting here, an outrage, a mockery in the eyes of all our enemies. By the long-haired Achaeans must be roaring with laughter. They thought you the bravest champion we could field, and just because of the handsome lustre on your limbs. But you have no pith, no fighting strength inside you. What? Is this the man who mustered the oarsmen once, who braved the seas in his racing deep-sea ships, trafficked with outlanders, carried off a woman far from her distant shores, a great beauty wed to a land of rugged spearmen? You! Curse to your father, your city, and all your people! A joy to our enemies, rank disgrace to yourself! So, you can't stand up to the battling Menelaus. You'd soon feel his force, the man you robbed of his sumptuous, warm wife. No use to you then, the fine lyre, and these gifts of Aphrodite, your long flowing locks and your striking looks, not when you roll and couple with the dust. What cowards! The men of Troy! Or years ago they'd have decked you out in a suit of rocky armour, stoned you to death for all the wrongs you've done. And Paris, magnificent as a god, replied, Ah, Hector, you criticize me fairly, yes, nothing unfair, beyond what I deserve. The heart inside you is always tempered hard, like an axe that goes through wood when a shipwright cuts out ship timbers with every ounce of skill and the blade's weight drives the man's stroke. So the heart inside your chest is never daunted. Still, don't fling in my face the lovely gifts of golden Aphrodite. Not to be tossed aside, the gifts of the gods, those glories. Whatever the gods give of their own free will, how could we ever choose them for ourselves? Now, though, if you really want me to fight to the finish here, have all Trojans and Argives take their seats, and pit me against Menelaus, dear to Ares, right between the lines. We'll fight it out for Helen and all her wealth, and the one who proves the better man and wins, he'll take those treasures fairly, lead the woman home. The rest will seal in blood their binding pacts of friendship. Our people will live in peace on the rich soil of Troy. Our enemies sail home to the stallion land of Argos, the land of Achaea, where the women are a wonder. When Hector heard that challenge, he rejoiced, and right in the no-man's land along his lines he strode, gripping his spear mid-haft, staving men to a standstill. But the long-haired Argive archers aimed at Hector, trying to cut him down with arrows, hurling rocks, till King Agamemnon cried out in a ringing voice,
"Hold back, Argives! Sons of Achaea, stop your salvos! Look, Hector with that flashing helmet of his! The man is trying to tell us something now!"
They hailed their attack. Quickly men fell silent, and Hector pleaded, appealing to both armed camps.
"Hear me, Trojans, Achaeans geared for combat. Hear the challenge of Paris, the man who caused our long, hard campaign. He urges all the Trojans, all the Argives too, to lay their fine armor down on the fertile earth, while Paris himself and the warrior Menelaus take the field between you and fight it out, for Helen and all her wealth in single combat. And the one who proves the better man and wins, he'll take those treasures fairly, lead the woman home. The rest will seal in blood their binding pacts of friendship."
He stopped. A hushed silence held the ranks. And Menelaus, whose cry could marshal armies, urged both sides,
Now hear me out as well. Such limited vengeance hurts me most of all. But I intend that we will part in peace at last, Trojans and Achaeans. Look what heavy casualties you have suffered, just for me, my violent quarrel, and Paris, who brought it on you all. Now we'll fight, and death to the one marked out for doom and death. But the rest will part in peace, and soon, soon. Bring two lambs, a white male and a black ewe for the sun and earth, and we'll bring a third for Zeus. And lead on Priam, too, Priam in all his power, so the king himself can seal our truce in blood. His royal sons are reckless, not to be trusted. No one must trample on the oath we swear to Zeus. The minds of the younger men are always flighty, but let an old man stand his ground among them, one who can see the days behind, the days ahead. That is the best hope for peace, for both our armies.
The Achaean and Trojan forces both exulted, hoping this would end the agonies of war. They hauled their chariots up in ranks, at rest. The troops dismounted, and stripped away their arms, and laid them down on the earth, crowded together. Hardly a foot of ploughland showed between them. Back to the city, Hector sent two heralds now, to bring the lambs at once, and summon Priam, while King Agamemnon sent Talthybius off, heading down to the ships for one more lamb. The herald obeyed his captain's orders quickly. And now a messenger went to white-armed Helen, too. Iris, looking for all the world like Hector's sister, wed to Antenor's son, Helicaon's bride, Laodice, the loveliest daughter Priam ever bred. And Iris came on Helen in her rooms, weaving a growing web, a dark red folding robe, working into the weft the endless bloody struggles stallion-breaking Trojans and Argives, armed in bronze, had suffered, all for her at the god of battle's hands. Iris, racing the wind, brushed close and whispered, "Come, dear girl, come quickly, so you can see what wondrous things they're doing. Stallion-breaking Trojans and Argives, armed in bronze. A moment ago, they longed to kill each other, longed for heartbreaking, inhuman warfare on the plain. Now, those very warriors stand at ease, in silence. The fighting stopped. They lean against their shields, their long lances stuck in the ground beside them. Think of it. Paris and Menelaus, loved by Ares, go to fight it out with their rugged spears, all for you. And the man who wins that duel, you'll be called his wife." And with those words, the goddess filled her heart with yearning warm and deep for her husband long ago, her city, and her parents. Quickly, cloaking herself in shimmering linen, out of her rooms she rushed, live tears welling. And not alone, two of her women followed close behind. Aethra, Pittheus's daughter, and Clymene, eyes wide, and they soon reached the looming Scaean gates. And there they were, gathered around Priam, Panthous and Thymoetes, Lampus and Critias, Hicataean, the grey aid of Ares, then those two with unfailing good sense, Ucalegon and Antenor. The old men of the realm held seats above the gates. Long years had brought their fighting days to a halt, but they were eloquent speakers still, clear as cicadas settled on treetops, lifting their voices through the forest, rising softly, falling, dying away. So they waited, the old chiefs of Troy, as they sat aloft the tower, and catching sight of Helen moving along the ramparts, they murmured one to another, gentle, winged words. Who on earth could blame them? Ah, no wonder the men of Troy and Argives under arms have suffered years of agony all for her, for such a woman. Beauty, terrible beauty. A deathless goddess, so she strikes our eyes. But still, ravishing as she is, let her go home in the long ships and not be left behind. For us and our children down the years, an irresistible sorrow. They murmured low. But Priam, raising his voice, called across to Helen, "Come over here,
Dear child, sit in front of me, so you can see your husband of long ago, your kinsmen, and your people. I don't blame you. I hold the gods to blame. They are the ones who brought this war upon me, devastating war against the Achaeans. Here, come closer. Tell me the name of that tremendous fighter. Look, who's that Achaean there, so stark and grand? Many others afield are much taller, true, but I've never yet set eyes on one so regal, so majestic. That man must be a king.
And Helen, the radiance of women, answered Priam, I revere you so, dear father, dread you, too. If only death had pleased me then, grim death, that day I followed your son to Troy, forsaking my marriage bed, my kinsman and my child, my favourite, now full grown, and the lovely comradeship of women my own age. Death never came, so now I can only waste away in tears. But about your question, yes, I have the answer. That man is Atreus's son, Agamemnon, lord of empires, both a mighty king and a strong spearman, too. And he used to be my kinsman, whore that I am. There was a world. Or was it all a dream?
Her voice broke, but the old king, lost in wonder, cried out,
How lucky you are, son of Atreus, child of fortune, your destiny so blessed. Look at the vast Achaean armies you command. Years ago I visited Phrygia, rife with vineyards, saw the Phrygian men with their swarming horses there, multitudes. The armies of Atreus, Mygdon like a god, encamped that time along the Sangarius river banks, and I took my stand among them, comrade in arms, the day the Amazon struck, a match for men in war. But not even those hordes could match these hordes of yours, your fiery-eyed Achaeans.
And citing Odysseus next, the old king questioned Helen.
Come, dear child, tell me of that one, too. Now, who is he? Shorter than Atreus' son Agamemnon, clearly, but broader across the shoulders, through the chest. There, you see? His armor's heaped on the green field, but the man keeps ranging the ranks of fighters like a ram. Yes, he looks to me like a thick-fleeced bellwether ram, making his way through a big mass of sheep flocks, shining silver-gray.
Helen, the child of Zeus, replied, That's Laertes' son, the great tactician Odysseus. He was bred in the land of Ithaca, rocky ground, and he's quick at every treachery under the sun. The man of twists and turns. Helen paused, and the shrewd Antenor carried on her story.
Straight to the point, my lady. Very true. Once in the past he came our way, King Odysseus heading the embassy they sent for your release, together with Menelaus, dear to Ares. I hosted them, treated them warmly in my halls, and learned the ways of both, their strategies, their traits. Now, when they mingled with our Trojans in assembly, standing side by side, Menelaus's shoulders mounted over his friend's in height and spread. When both were seated, Odysseus looked more lordly. But when they spun their appeals before us all, Menelaus spoke out quickly, his words racing, few, but clear as a bell, nothing long-winded or off the mark, though, in fact, the man was younger. But when Odysseus sprang up, the famed tactician would just stand there, staring down, hard, his eyes fixed on the ground, never shifting his scepter back and forth, clutching it stiff and still like a mindless man. You'd think him a sullen fellow, or just plain fool. But when he let loose that great voice from his chest, and the words came piling on like a driving winter blizzard, then no man alive could rival Odysseus. Odysseus, we no longer gazed in wonder at his looks.
Catching sight of a third fighter, Ajax, the old king asked her next,
Who's that other Achaean? So powerful, so well built. He towers over the Argives, his head, his massive shoulders.
And Helen, in all her radiance, her long robes, replied, Why, that's the giant Ajax, bulwark of the Achaeans, and Idomeneus over there, standing with his Cretans like a god, you see? and the Cretan captains form a ring around him. How often Menelaus, my good soldier, would host him in our halls in the old days, when he'd sail across from Crete. And now I see them all, the fiery-eyed Achaeans. I know them all by heart, and I could tell their names. But two I cannot find, and they're captains of the armies. Castor, breaker of horses, and the hardy boxer Polydeuces, my blood brothers. Mother bore them both. Perhaps they never crossed over from Lacedaemon's lovely hills, or come they did, sailing here in the deep-sea ships, but now they refuse to join the men in battle, dreading the scorn, the curses hurled at me.
So she wavered, but the earth already held them fast, long dead in the life-giving earth of Lacedaemon, the dear land of their fathers. Now through Troy the heralds brought the offerings for the gods, sacred victims to bind and seal the oaths, two lambs and the wine that warms the heart, the yield of the vine, filling a goatskin sack, and the herald, Idaeus, carried a gleaming bowl and golden wine-cups. Reaching the old king's side, the crier roused him sharply. "Son of Laomedon, rise up! They are calling for you now, commanders of both armies, stallion-breaking Trojans and Argives armed in bronze. Come down to the plain so you can seal our oaths. Now Paris and Menelaus, Atrides, loved by Ares, will fight it out with their rugged spears for Helen. And Helen and all her treasures go to the man who wins. The rest will seal in blood their binding pacts of friendship. Our people will live in peace on the rich soil of Troy. Our enemies sail home to the stallion land of Argos, the land of Achaea, where the women are a wonder." A shudder went shooting through the old man, but he told his men to yoke the team at once. They promptly obeyed, and Priam climbed aboard, pulling the reins back taut. Antenor flanked him, mounting the gleaming car, and both men drove the team through the Scaean gates, heading toward the plain. Reaching the front, they climbed down from the chariot, on to the earth that feeds us all, and into the space between Achaean and Trojan lines they marched. Lord Agamemnon rose at once to greet them both, with the great tactician Odysseus by his side. The noble heralds brought on the victims marked for the gods to seal and bind the oaths. They mixed the contenders' wine in a large bowl, and rinsed the warlord's waiting hands with water. Atreus's son drew forth a dagger, always slung at his battle-sword's big sheath, cut some tufts from the lambs' heads, and heralds passed them round to Achaean and Trojan captains. Then Atreus's son Agamemnon stood in front of all, lifted his arms, and prayed in his deep, resounding voice,
"Father Zeus, ruling over us all from Ida, God of greatness, God of glory. Helios, sun above us, you who see all, hear all things, rivers and earth, and you beneath the ground who punish the dead, whoever broke his oath, be witness here, protect our binding pacts. If Paris brings Menelaus down in blood, he keeps Helen himself and all her wealth, and we sail home in our racing deep-sea ships. But if red-haired Menelaus brings down Paris, the Trojans surrender Helen and all her treasures, and they pay us reparations fair and fitting, a price to inspire generations still to come. But if Priam and Priam's sons refuse to pay, refuse me, Agamemnon, with Paris beaten down, then I myself will fight it out for the ransom. I'll battle here to the end of our long war."
On those terms, he dragged his ruthless dagger across the lambs' throats, and let them fall to the ground, dying, gasping away their life-breath, cut short by the sharp bronze. Then, dipping up the wine from the mixing bowls, brimming their cups, pouring them on the earth, men said their prayers to the gods who never die. You could hear some Trojan or Achaean calling,
"Zeus, God of greatness, God of glory, O you immortals, whichever contenders trample on this treaty first, spill their brains on the ground as this wine spills, theirs, their children's too, their enemies rape their wives."
But Zeus would not fulfill their prayers. Not yet. Now Priam rose in their midst and took his leave.
"Hear me, Trojans. Achaeans geared for combat. Home I go to windy Ilium, straight home now. This is more than I can bear, I tell you, to watch my son do battle with Menelaus, loved by the war god, right before my eyes. Zeus knows, no doubt, and every immortal too, which fighter is doomed to end all this in death.
And laying the victims in the chariot, noble Priam climbed aboard, pulling the reins back taut. Antenor flanked him, mounting the gleaming car, and back they drove again, heading home to Troy. But Priam's son, Prince Hector, and royal Odysseus, measured off the ground for single combat first, then dropped two stones in a helmet, lots for casting. Who would be first to hurl his bronze-tipped spear? The armies prayed, and stretched their hands to the gods. You could hear some Trojan or Achaean pleading.
Father Zeus, ruling over us all from Ida, god of greatness, glory, whoever brought this war on both our countries, let him rot and sink to the house of death, but let our pacts of friendship all hold fast.
So they prayed, as tall Hector, eyes averted under his flashing helmet, shook the two lots hard, and Paris's lot leapt out. The troops sat down by rank, each beside his horses, pawing the ground where blazoned war gear lay. And now one warrior, harnessed, burnished armour on his back, magnificent Paris, fair-haired Helen's consort. First, he wrapped his legs with well-made greaves, fastened behind the heels with silver ankle clasps. Next, he strapped a breastplate round his chest, his brother Lycaon's that fitted him so well. Then over his shoulder, Paris slung his sword, the fine bronze blade with its silver-studded hilt, and then the shield strap and his sturdy, massive shield. And over his powerful head, he set a well-forged helmet, the horsehair crest atop it tossing, bristling terror. And last, he grasped a spear that matched his grip. Following step by step, the fighting Menelaus strapped on armour too. Both men armed at opposing sides of the forces. Into the no-man's land between the lines they strode, glances menacing, wild excitement seizing all who watched, the stallion-breaking Trojans and Argive men-at-arms. Striking a stand in the dueling ground just cleared, they brandished spears at each other, tense with fury. Suddenly, Paris hurled. His spear's long shadow flew, and the shaft hit Menelaus's round shield full center. Not pounding through, the brazen point bent back in the tough armor. But his turn next. Menelaus reared with a bronze lance and a prayer to Father Zeus. Zeus, king, give me revenge. He wronged me first. Illustrious Paris, crush him under my hand. So, even among the men to come, a man may shrink from wounding the host who showers him with kindness. Shaking his spear, he hurled, and its long shadow flew, and the shaft hit Paris's round shield, hit full center. Straight through the gleaming hide the heavy weapon drove, ripping down and in through the breastplate finely worked. Tearing the war-shirt, close by Paris's flank it jabbed, but the Trojan swerved aside and dodged black death. So now Menelaus drew his sword with silver studs, and hoisting the weapon high, brought it crashing down on the helmet ridge, but the blade smashed where it struck, jagged shatters flying. It dropped from Atreides' hand. And the hero cried out, scanning the blank skies,
"Father Zeus, no god more destructive than you. Here I thought I'd punish Paris for all his outrage. Now my sword is shattered, right in my hands. Look, my spear flew from my grip for nothing. I never hit him."
Lunging at Paris, he grabbed his horsehair crest, swung him round, started to drag him into Argive lines. And now the braided chin-strap holding his helmet tight was gouging his soft throat. Paris was choking, strangling. Now he'd have hauled him off and won undying glory. But Aphrodite, Zeus's daughter, quick to the mark, snapped the rawhide strap, cut from a bludgeoned ox, and the helmet came off, empty in Menelaus's fist. Whirling it round, the fighter sent it flying into his Argives, scrambling fast to retrieve it. Back at his man he sprang, enraged with brazen spear, mad for the kill. But Aphrodite snatched Paris away. Easy work for a god, wrapped him in swirls of mist, and set him down in his bedroom filled with scent. Then off she went herself to summon Helen, and found her there on the steep jutting tower, with a troop of Trojan women clustered round her. The goddess reached and tugged at her fragrant robe, whispering low, for all the world like an old crone, the old weaver, who, when they lived in Lacedaemon, wove her fine woolens, and Helen held her dear. Like her to the life, immortal love invited.
"Quickly, Paris is calling for you. Come back home. There he is in the bedroom, the bed with inlaid rings. He's glistening in all his beauty and his robes. You'd never dream he's come from fighting a man. You'd think he's off to a dance, or slipped away from the dancing, stretching out at ease."
Enticing, so that the heart in Helen's breast began to race. She knew the goddess at once, the long, lithe neck, the smooth, full breasts, and the fire in those eyes. And she was amazed. She burst out with her name.
"Maddening one, my goddess! Oh, what now? Lusting to lure me to my ruin yet again? Where will you drive me next?
Off and away to other grand, luxurious cities. Out to Phrygia, out to Meonia's tempting country? Have you a favourite mortal man there, too?
But why now?
Because Menelaus has beaten your handsome Paris, and hateful as I am, he longs to take me home. Is that why you beckon here beside me now, with all the immortal cunning in your heart?
Well, go to him yourself. You hover beside him. Abandon the god's high road, and be a mortal. Never set foot again on Mount Olympus. Never. Suffer for Paris, protect Paris for eternity, until he makes you his wedded wife, that or his slave. Not I. I'll never go back again. It would be wrong, disgraceful to share that coward's bed once more. The women of Troy would scorn me down the years. Oh, the torment, never-ending heartbreak.
But Aphrodite rounded on her in fury.
Don't provoke me, wretched headstrong girl, or in my immortal rage I may just toss you over. Hate you, as I adore you now, with a vengeance. I might make you the butt of hard, withering hate from both sides at once, Trojans and Achaeans. Then your fate can tread you down to dust.
So she threatened, and Helen, the daughter of mighty Zeus, was terrified. Shrouding herself in her glinting silver robes, she went along in silence. None of her women saw her go. The goddess led the way. And once they arrived at Paris's sumptuous halls, the attendants briskly turned to their own work, as Helen, in all her radiance, climbed the steps to the bedroom under the high vaulting roof. There Aphrodite quickly brought her a chair, the goddess herself with her everlasting smile, and set it down, face to face with Paris. And there Helen sat, Helen, the child of Zeus, whose shield is storm and lightning, glancing away.